At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
From the unexplained to the mundane, come join us on a journey to the fringe. Hello and welcome to Journey to the Fringe, where we say what others won't. Chelsea, are you ready for it?
Yeah.
A do. That's what this is that we're doing. It's a do. You know, like the idle wasting of time, not moving to the topic or not moving it forward. That's what this is. Nobody says it, but we're going to tell you. That's all. Now, without further ado, we are your podcast hosts, Taylor and Chelsea, here today reliving the past with an oldie but a goodie that really deserves a re-record because sometimes we're not great with the microphones and audio and all the things that go along with being a podcaster, but
we just make
good episodes. And so we had to relive an old one from the past. So Chelsea, today we are going to hit back on our topic of that time that the head of the UN was assassinated.
Oh yeah, I forgot what one you're redoing.
I don't think you actually remember most of this episode. It was kind of a weird outside of our normal like scope episode.
It was.
There's also, apparently I did do some freehand while we were doing it, so I had to go look up a few things while I was getting the script ready. But this is a fun episode. I think it helps us establish. There's so many conspiracy theories about the UN and what it's trying to push on everybody that I think it's important to actually look at what has happened to the UN and how they don't actually have as much power as people would think. Specifically, how powers have actually pushed them around in the past quite a lot.
Now that you say that, I'm not sure exactly what they do. I don't really hear from them ever.
They pretend to bring unity. You hear about it a lot with regards to Israel and its treatment of Gaza and Palestinians. Basically, They always have a vote. The entire world's on one side and the US and maybe one or two of its allies and Israel are on the other and they just veto everything.
Yeah.
Fairly ineffective. They do have a few arms that do well. UNESCO.
Oh, I know them.
They do cultural things. Children's Emergency Fund, UNICEF, does some good work.
Oh yeah, I know them too.
They have quite a few different arms that actually do quite a bit of good things, but overall, it was meant to be world unity and give direction, and it really hasn't been able to do that in a long time. And hey, maybe through learning about its history, we can learn about what it was meant to be and how it's falling short.
Let's learn about it. It being your episode.
Well, sure. I guess that's one way to put it.
Yeah.
Now, you always have to start an episode where you're talking about the UN. You gotta start it before the UN was a thing, because the UN's not a thing until after two fairly significant wars, and it's not the first attempt at a UN-like thing. Now, the first one that really came about, Chelsea, do you know what it is?
The first UN thing?
Yeah. Prior to it.
No.
Woodrow Wilson. It's called a paper tiger. Okay. No. Well, it's the League of Nations.
Ring a bell. Okay. Oh, right. Yeah, I knew this from the first episode.
And this came after World War I. It was born out of the destruction and disillusionment arising from World War I. And it was the most ambitious attempt that had ever been made to construct a peaceful global order. It was rooted in a comprehensive liberal critique of the pre-war international system, which was widely believed to have been the cause of the carnage of World War I. Which was really, yeah, the pre-war international system was a bunch of brothers with Habsburg chins and hemophilia that turned their spat into millions and millions of people dying in trenches and of disease. So it makes a lot of sense to think that that's the issue.
Yeah.
Now, the idea of the League was to eliminate four flaws of the old European state. In place of monarchical family spats, a world of independent nation states was emerging and should free of outside interference. The secret diplomacy of the old order would be replaced by the open discussion and resolution of disputes. The military alliance blocs would be replaced by a system of collective guarantees of security, and agreed disarmament would prevent the recurrence of the kind of arms races that had racked up international tensions in the pre-war decade. There was a previous Congress system in which the European great powers held occasional summit meetings to discuss issues they found urgent. The surviving victorious great powers at the end of the Great War, Britain and France, would have preferred to go no further than regularizing the old Congress system. But Woodrow Wilson had different ideas ideas, the president of the US at the time. He pushed forward the creation of a more comprehensive global organization, which would include all independent states and in which even the smallest state would have a voice. He would really be pushing for that too, because they're not part of the old world hierarchy at that time, having been across the pond and not really on anybody's mind outside of the revolution prior to that.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the way Wilson was thinking about the way that self-determination will work in the real world and about getting his idea for a community of power off the ground, it remained vague. Partly this was to avoid alarming US isolationists' opinions, but in any case, when the League Covenant was agreed at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, the US Senate refused to ratify it. How the League would have worked with American anticipation remains one of the great what-ifs of modern history. As it was, the direction of the system was left in the hands of states, primarily Britain and France, who wanted that other system, whose altruism was questionable, and whose economic resources had been crippled by the war. Yet the League of Nations did work surprisingly well for about a decade, which, you know, if you raise a child to 10 years, you get credit, I think.
Yeah.
Unless they murdered millions of people after that decade line. By December of 1920, 48 states had signed the League Covenant, pledging to work together to eliminate aggression between the countries. A series of disputes between Germany and Poland over Upper Silesia, between Italy and Greece, and between Greece and Bulgaria were resolved under its auspices. And these were the kinds of conflicts that triggered World War I. So good for them.
Okay.
Yeah, so they did do some good things.
Yeah, I was just wondering, what did they do? They did that.
Yeah, they did that, but not major powers, just like smaller powers in the world at that time, and Europe still. The proliferation of League activity, however, carried risks. As one of its founders, Lloyd George, put it, quote, "It had weak links spreading everywhere, no grip anywhere," end quote. Grip ultimately meant the capacity to use force. When the crucial concept of collective security was put to the acid test in the 1930s, it dissolved. Once big power started to challenge the status quo, as Japan did in Manchuria, the League found it practically impossible to reach a clear verdict on who was guilty of aggression. Which, if you remember that story from, what episode was that in where we covered the Manchuria bombings?
Japan.
Yeah, I remember, but Japan we did. Ones. Right, right, the history of Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I forgot we did a three-part series on that.
We did. That was fun. Japan's pretty horrible.
Or still more disastrously, in the case of Italian pressure on Abyssinia, the guilt was clear enough, but the key powers, Britain and France, were unwilling to antagonize the guilty party because of their wider strategic fears. Also, maybe a little bit of racism in there because Abyssinia is an African country. A failed attempt to impose an oil embargo on Italy demonstrated that any credible system of economic sanctions was far away. And between the humiliation of seeing one of its members, Austria, taken over by Germany in 1938 without even a formal protest, and the absurdity of expelling the USSR after the outbreak of World War II in 1939, an event that neither the USSR nor the League were involved in. After this, the League pretty much ceases while World War II happens.
Oh, okay.
Now, World War II happens. People believe it's probably a good idea to have some sort of thing like the League of Nations around once World War II ends. And in 1945, many nations are in ruins and the world wanted peace. Representatives of 50 countries gathered at the United Nations Conference on International Organization in San Francisco. On April 25th, 1945, for 2 months, they proceeded to draft and then sign the UN Charter, which created a new international organization, the United Nations, which it was hoped would prevent another world war like the one they had just lived through. And hey, to the UN's credit, there hasn't been another world war since.
I was just gonna say, have they been successful? Yes.
I think so, for the most part. Although there were a lot of close calls like the Korean War in the 1950s.
Yeah.
4 months after the San Francisco conference ended, on October 24th, 1945, the United Nations officially began. When it came into existence after its charter had been ratified by China, France, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, and the United States, the five major powers of the UN. As of April 20th, 1946, the League of Nations ceased to exist, having handed over all of its assets to the UN and having granted the new UN Secretariat full control of its libraries and archives. And here's just a brief kind of explanation of the UN from the UN. The structure of the United Nations was to give a much stronger position to the traditional great powers through the UN Security Council. The most significant thing about its creation, perhaps, is that at this time, the USA did not back away. A significant number of the old League's aims and methods were transmitted into the UN in 1945. Among these were not only such low-key but effective institutions as the International Court and the International Labor Organization, but also the working assumption of the Secretary and some key operations, including those that would soon come to be called peacekeeping operations. The UN may have almost stumbled sideways into its peacekeeping role, but the motive and sustaining force in the process was the survival and the strengthening of the expectations of international involvement in the preservation of global security. Gradually, this came to include the defense of human rights, as well as the resolution of territorial conflict. The UN's first attempt to resolve a serious conflict in Palestine in 1947-1948 was unsuccessful, even disastrous. It failed to implement its own partition plan, and its special mediator was assassinated. Other UN organizations had a shorter but more spectacular life, notably the operation in Congo. We're going to talk about that, which ends up being a big part of this episode, from 1960-64, which prefigured the alarming future for missions to states that were dissolving into civil war. In the Congo, the UN found itself using military force against Katangan rebels to preserve the unity of the state of Congo, a departure from the principle of strict neutrality, which has usually been thought vital to the success of its peacekeeping missions. Dealing with such internal conflict was a far more ambitious and demanding task than the traditional role of assisting consenting states to observe ceasefires. In effect, it showed the UN might need to take governmental responsibilities in some situations. Now, the UN, as you may have guessed, is still around. It has 193 member states. Its purpose is to maintain international peace and security, to promote human rights, and to provide a forum for discussion of global issues. The United Nations Systems of Organization is comprised of main organ specialized agencies, programs and funds, research and training institutes, and a variety of affiliated and related bodies. The main organs are the General Assembly, the Security Council, the Economic and Social Council, the Trusteeship Council, the International Court of Justice, and the UN Secretariat. The Charter of the UN defines the tasks and functions of each organ. The Secretary General is the Chief Administrative Officer of the UN and is elected by the General Assembly. The organization is financed by assessed and voluntary contributions from its member states. Just to kind of give you an idea how it functions today. Does that give you a bit of an overview, Chelsea, I guess, of the whole situation with global attempts to work together?
I think so, yeah. I think I have a general idea of it.
Okay.
And their goals.
Okay, good. Okay. Because now we're going to focus more on the man at hand that we're going to be talking about, Dag Hammarskjöld. Now, the development towards taking responsibility in countries at risk of disintegration was due to a dramatic increase in the prestige and initiative of the UN Secretary General. This was particularly true at the time when the position was held by the charismatic Dag Hammarskjöld. Mr. Hammarskjöld was a Swedish economist and diplomat who served as the second Secretary General of the United Nations. As of 2023, he remains the youngest person to have ever held the post, having been only 47 when he was appointed. He was the son of Hjalmar Hammarskjöld, who served as Prime Minister of Sweden from 1914 to 1917. Hammarskjöld was and remains well-regarded internationally as a capable diplomat and administrator, and his efforts to resolve various global crises led to him being the only posthumous recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. He is considered to be one of the two best UN Secretaries General, and his appointment has been hailed as one of the most notable successes of the organization. US President JFK called Hammarskjöld the greatest statesman of our century.
Ow.
Yeah, he's got fairly good credentials behind him. He gets appointed to this role in 1953. Immediately following the assumption of the Secretariat, Hammarskjöld attempted to establish good rapport with his staff. He made a point of visiting every UN department to shake hands with as many workers as possible, eating in the cafeteria as often as possible, and relinquishing the Secretary General's private elevator for general use.
Oh, what a good guy.
Apparently kind of liked to be around people and not just held above them. So kind of what you expect from a leader, I hope.
I've never even heard of a separate elevator for outside of the regular folk.
He began his term by establishing his own secretariat of 4,000 administrators and setting up regulations that define their responsibilities. He was also actively engaged in small projects relating to the UN working environment. For example, he spearheaded the building of a meditation room at the UN headquarters where people can withdraw into themselves in silence regardless of their faith, creed, or religion. Keep in mind, again, this is the 50s, so fairly ahead of his time. During his term, Hammarskjöld tried to improve relations between Israel and the Arab states. Other highlights included in 1955, a visit to China to negotiate the release of 11 captured U.S. pilots who had been serving in the Korean War, the 1956 establishment of the United Nations Emergency Force, and its intervention in the 1956 Suez Crisis, which I didn't look into. I just think it's easy enough to put in there. In 1960, the newly independent Congo asked for UN aid in defusing the Congo crisis. Hammarskjöld made 4 trips to the Congo, but his efforts towards the decolonization of Africa were considered insufficient by the Soviet Union. We'll get back to that in a bit here.
I'll take your word.
In September of 1960, the Soviet government denounced his decision to send a UN emergency force to keep the peace. They demanded his resignation and the replacement of the office of Secretary General by a 3-man directorate with a built-in veto, the Troika, they called it. The objective was citing the memoirs of Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev to, quote, equally represent interests of 3 groups of countries, capitalists, socialists, and recently independent. So they didn't like the idea of just one person being in charge of it here.
In just this one situation in the Congo?
In the UN in general. They didn't like the idea of one person being in charge of it because they generally would have one group's interest above all. So there should be one who's looking out for all interests.
I get it. And then is this because of him going to the Congo by himself? Or this is happening at the same time?
It's kind of something that just springs from it. Okay. And the Soviet Union in this situation is pro-decolonization. There could be several reasons for it. One of them is that the colonization of Africa was inherently exploitive for capitalist purposes.
Yeah.
People might just say they were butthurt that they missed out on colonizing. In any event, they are ethically on the correct side, whether or not it's for ethical reasons.
Okay.
So you might ask yourself, what is the Congo crisis?
Yeah, I was also thinking that. I should have said it out loud, but can you please tell us now, please?
The Congo was one of the parts of Africa that was colonized. It was colonized by Belgium. Particularly, it was a colony held by King Leopold II. If you want extensive history on what happened there, go listen to Behind the Bastards. They have a 2-part series on Leopold II and his exploitation of Congo. If not, here's the absolute coal notes as I can give them to you. Leopold II wanted to exploit the Congo for its natural resources as much as possible. Particularly, what was there was rubber. And he knew that he had a monopoly on it, but he wouldn't for long, so he had to get it out of there as fast as possible. Congolese people were forced to meet impossible rubber quotas under the threat of violence leading to widespread suffering and death. These threats of violence were, if you don't meet your rubber quota, we are going to cut your kid's hand off. If you do it again, we're going to cut their other hand off. If you do it again, we're going to kill them.
Oh no, I remember the story.
Yeah. They established a private army that used extreme violence, including mutilation and executions, including the cutting off of hands, ears, and feet. These private armies were given a set number of bullets. Basically, they're given each time they shot a bullet, it was a part of the body they had to show that they used it for a good purpose. So if they used these bullets for, say, hunting in the jungle, they would go butcher somebody with a machete to show that they used the bullet on that so they could get more bullets. Like, it is super fucked up.
Yeah, no kidding.
This brutal exploitation combined with famine, disease, and forced displacement led to a catastrophic decline in the Congolese population over Leopold's reign. Some estimates suggest that up to 10 million Congolese people died during Leopold's rule. That was between the 1890s and 1908. So 10 million people in the middle of Africa died because of what happened there with the colonization. But nobody knows the exact numbers. They are hotly debated. Traditional societies and cultures were dismantled. Local populations were subjected to forced assimilation and exploitation. Congolese people were treated as property with no rights or freedoms. Women and children were particularly vulnerable to abuse, including sexual violence. Reports of these atrocities by activists like Edmund Dean Morrill and Roger Casement led to international condemnation. And in 1908, Leopold was forced to cede the control of Congo to the Belgian state, which was not perfect, but it's at least better than what he was doing. 1908 to 1960, Belgium's ruling it. Congo wants to be its own independent state. That's this yearning from post-World War II around the world that people have a right to self-determination, which Congo finally gets in June of 1960. However, this new country, the country of Congo, is immediately descended into a political chaos, which is known as the Congo Crisis. On July 11th of 1960, less than 2 weeks after the country formally gained independence, a politician named Moise Tshombe declared that the southernmost province of the Congo was an independent nation known as the state of Katanga. Katanga is the copper belt, and a very lucrative mining operation was located there, and it was the wealthiest province of the Congo. The Belgians, French, and British wanted influence in this wealthy region, and they supported Katanga's movement in practice, if not in name, because they couldn't be attached to it because Europe technically was hands-off at this time. Now, despite UN regulations forbidding countries from directly supporting the secessionists in Congo, members of the European armed forces became hired mercenaries in Katanga's army. This is in direct conflict with Patrice Lumumba, who is the prime minister of Congo at the time. He appealed to the UN for forces to end the secessionist movement of Tshangé. The UN initially refuses this, considering the rebellion an internal issue. Patrice Lumumba had managed to acquire Soviet weapons for the Congolese army before he was deposed as prime minister by Mobutu Sese Seko in November of 1960 and killed in early 1961. This led the UN to pass Resolution 161, which authorized UN force to take, quote, all appropriate measures, end quote, to prevent civil war in the Congo. Essentially, they authorized the UN to take offensive measures against the Katangan state. The conflict came to a close in January of 1963 after the UN and US forces overwhelmed the Katangan military and Moise Tshembe stepped down as president of Katanga. During this time, the UN sent nearly 20,000 strong peacekeeping forces to restore order in the Congo-Kinshasa region. Hammarskjöld's refusal to place peacekeepers in the service of Lumumba's constitutionally elected government provoked a strong reaction of disapproval from the Soviets. In February of 1961, the UN authorized the peacekeeping forces to use military force to prevent the civil war. And the Blue Helmets' attack on Katanga caused Tshombe to flee to Zambia. Hammarskjöld's erratic attitude in not providing support to Lumumba's government, which had been elected by popular vote, drew severe criticism among non-aligned countries and communist and socialist countries. And in the end, his actions were supported only by the United Nations and, strangely enough, Belgium. This is going on. This ends up getting dealt with, and the Congo, of course, famously very prosperous after this all took place. It's one of the most prosperous nations on Earth. I may be mixing it up with the African nation from the Marvel comics, though.
That's over my head, unfortunately.
Okay.
I don't know what that means.
But while this is all going on, September 18, 1961, Hammarskjöld was en route to negotiate a ceasefire between the United Nations Operation of the Congo Forces and Katangi's troops under Moise Tshombe.
Okay, hold on. I have a question. I thought that other countries didn't like him going in on his own. They wanted other people to be represented.
Oh, do you mean the Soviets?
Yeah.
They never quite liked how the UN was set up. Again, they said that there should be three people that headed up called the Troika,
which is
a group that represents the capitalists, a group that represents the socialists, and a group that represents the unaligned. That doesn't happen. It never happens in the
UN. Okay, so this guy's still here.
So nothing he's still changes. Ahead of
this guy's
yeah,
still
nothing
here.
Changes. Okay. It never does.
Got it.
On December 18th, 1961, Hammarskjöld was en route to negotiate a ceasefire between the UN Operation in the Congo forces and Katangi's troops under Moise Tshombe. His Douglas D6 airliner, SEBDY, crashed near Ndola, northern Rhodesia, which is now Zambia. Hammarskjöld perished as a result of this crash, as did all the 15 other passengers. Hammarskjöld's death set off a succession crisis at the UN, and as there was no line of succession and the Security Council had to vote on its successor. A 1962 Rhodesian inquiry concluded that pilot error was to blame. While a later UN investigation could not determine the cause of the crash, a CIA report claimed the KGB was responsible. So as this is going on, nobody knows what happened to the plane. There's going to be a lot of accusations thrown out there.
Okay.
The day after the crash, former US President Harry Truman commented that Hammarskjöld, quote, was on the point of getting something done when they killed him. Notice that I said when they killed him, end quote. In 1998, documents surfaced suggesting CIA, MI6, and/or Belgian mining interests involvement via a South African paramilitary organization. The information was contained in a file from the South African National Intelligence Agency turned to the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission in relation to the 1993 assassination of Chris Hani, leader of the South African Communist Party. These documents included an alleged plot to remove Hammarskjöld and contained a supposed statement from CIA Director Alan Dulles that, quote, Daeg is becoming troublesome and should be removed, end quote. Hammarskjöld's mission to end war over the mineral-rich Katangi secession from the newly formed Republic of the Congo was contrary to the interests of those organizations. However, these documents were copies rather than originals, precluding substantiation of authenticity through ink and paper testing. So no way to tell if they're actually real. But what is that? 4 accusations already. We've got pilot error, we've got potentially KGB, and then we got CIA, MI6, and Belgian mining interests that all could potentially have brought this plane down. Plus, this South African paramilitary organization, which have the papers that may or may not be real.
It just seems like he's a highly killable guy at this point.
Nobody quite likes what was going on there, and everybody had their own reasons for not liking Hammarskjöld's involvement.
Yeah.
Whether you say it's the USSR saying they don't like the idea of Hammarskjöld, or you say it's the European special interests who want their mining rights, or whether you say it's South Africans who just don't like the idea of Congo being an independent state like that.
Yeah.
But Chelsea, this keeps going, and we keep getting newer and newer information out of this. So in 2014, a newly declassified document revealed that the American ambassador to the Congo sent a cable to Washington, D.C., warning that the plane had been shot down by Belgian military pilot Jan van Rissigen, commander of the small Katangan Air Force. Van Rissigen died in 2007.
Hold on, what's his name?
Jan van Rissigen.
I love that name.
On March 16th, 2015, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon appointed members to an independent panel of experts to examine new information related to Hammarskjöld's death. The 3-member panel was led by Mohamed Shande Othman, the Chief Justice of Tanzania, and included Karen McCulley, Australia's representative to the International Civil Aviation Organization, and Henrik Larsen, a ballistic expert from the Danish National Police. The panel's 99-page report was released in July of 2015, and it assigned moderate value to 9 new eyewitness accounts and transcripts of radio transmissions. Accounts suggested that Hammarskjöld's plane was already on fire as it landed, and that other jet aircraft and intelligence agents were nearby. In 2016, the original document from the 1998 South African investigation surfaced, and those familiar with the investigation cautioned that even if authentic, the documents could have been initially authored as part of a disinformation campaign, which just adds so many wrinkles to what the hell that means.
So, sorry, I just need to ask the question because I forgot.
Yeah.
What year did he die? What year did the plane
61.
Die?
It was, I believe, October of 61.
Oh, and this is like September. Pretty recent in comparison to 61.
Yeah, 50 years later. 55 years later. In 2019, the documentary film Cold Case Hammarskjöld by Danish filmmaker Mads Brügger claimed that Jan van Rissigen had told a friend that he shot down Hammarskjöld's aircraft. This went against the official stance maintained by van Rissigen's family that he was not involved in the death of Hammarskjöld. According to an interview with van Rissigen's wife, he was in Rhodesia negotiating the purchase of a plane for the Katangan Air Force, with logbooks providing, quote, proof that he was not flying for the Katangans at that time, end quote. The documentary crew interviewed multiple colleagues of von Rissigen for the film, all of whom supported their theory. In an interview with Swedish historian Leif Hellström, von Rissigen claimed that he was not in southern Africa at the time the crash happened and dismissed the idea of this being potentially involved as fairy stories. I guess that's what they call them in Belgium. Previously unpublished documents continue to emerge from the UN or National Archives, one found in France amidst the Franz Foucault, the National Archives, and Pierre Fitt. In November of 2021 is a death warrant for Hammarskjöld signed by the infamous OAS, the secret organization
installed
in the French army at the time of Algeria's War of Independence. Super, super racist group. The document reads, quote, "It is high time to put an end to his harmful intrusion. This sentence common to justice and fairness to be carried out as soon as possible," end quote. The source was revealed by French journalist Morin Picard, according to whom the links between the white mercenaries in Katanga and OAS are overt. As years keep coming, more people get implicated as to who wanted him dead.
My name isn't in this, is it?
I don't know.
I wasn't alive.
Just give it
a
few more years. Just give it a few more years.
I wasn't alive.
There's a fairly good article on foreignpolicy.com just about this. It's called Dag Hammarskjöld's Plane Crash, What Really Happened to the UN Chief, that we're going to read an excerpt from. This is from February 15th, 2022, and it is written by Colm Lynch. which I don't know. That sounds like a fake name.
It really does.
Investigators fear they're running out of time to get to the bottom of what happened. Key witnesses from the time are dying off, and the UN inquiry led by former Tanzanian Chief Justice Mohamed Chande Othman is set to conclude in September without having established conclusively the circumstances of how the plane crashed. Othman has been investigating the case on and off for the UN since March of 2015. Over the years, Othman has amassed a significant amount of evidence, including the testimony of African eyewitnesses, suggesting foul play was largely ignored by early investigations in the 1960s. That goes against claims by British colonial authorities in Northern Rhodesia at the time that Hammarskjöld's death was an accident. Othman has explored a theory that a mysterious aircraft may have either fired on Hammarskjöld's plane or harassed the pilot, causing it to crash, or even that the plane may have been sabotaged by South African mercenaries, allegedly with the aid of the CIA and other Western intelligence agencies. The CIA previously denied involvement in the alleged Operation Celeste. Othman said in his two previous reports, issued in 2017 and 2019, that the burden of proof was on member states to demonstrate that they have conducted a thorough review of their records and archives, particularly from their intelligence agencies. Quote, "The continued non-disclosure of potentially relevant new information in the intelligence, security, and defense archives of member states constitutes the biggest barrier to our understanding the full truth on the event," end quote, Othman wrote in 2017. So they're trying to get to the bottom of it, and countries are not helping him. And it's multiple countries.
I mean, they're putting the onus on countries to investigate their own...
Not investigate themselves, people. Turn over any documents they have.
Yeah.
And they have documents. We know it. They keep accidentally coming out. Now, let's get through this. The governments of Zimbabwe, Zambia, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo have appointed high-ranking figures, including Sidney Sekaramia, a former Zimbabwean defense minister, to oversee the search for documents and provided full access to their archives. Belgium, France, and Sweden have also granted extensive access to their security files, but the U.S. and Britain have been less forthcoming, appointing relatively low-level officials to manage the search for relevant evidence and releasing the occasional confirmation of evidence brought to them by the U.N. So basically, if the U.N. uncovers something, they'll be like, oh yeah, that checks up with something we found.
Yeah.
But that's all they turn over. The air tragedy unfolded against the background of a bloody civil war that followed Congo's independence from Belgium. The war pitted Congolese nationalists against a secessionist rebellion in the mineral-rich state of Katanga, which had the backing of Belgian, Western mining companies, European mercenaries, and the CIA. Hammarskjöld was en route to Ndola in northern Rhodesia to negotiate a ceasefire with secessionist leader Moise Tshombe. The United Nations sent peacekeepers into Congo, where they ultimately found themselves at war with Katangan separatists and European mercenaries who were backed by Western mining interests. That's fun, isn't it?
I mean, that's the definition of fun.
Yeah. A Rhodesian commission of inquiry found that the pilot had miscalculated the height of the tree line and plowed into the forest canopy. A subsequent UN inquiry could not establish the cause of the crash, leaving open the possibility that Hammarskjöld could have died either as a result of an accident or foul play. Eyewitnesses in the area recall seeing a small plane approach the Albertina before there was a bright flash in the sky, then watching the flaming aircraft plunge into the forest, instantly killing everyone on board except the delegation's acting chief security officer, Harold Julian, who died from his injuries nearly a week later. Before his death, Julian, a former U.S. Marine, quote, suggested a threat or attack as the plane approached Ndola, possibly involving a sudden explosion, end quote, according to Othman's reports. Quote, this evidence was augmented in 2018-19 by information from Zimbabwe that showed that Northern Rhodesian authorities had tried to stifle those statements of Julian from being made public, end quote, Othman's report found in 2019.
It's not suspicious.
Othman has cited documents indicating that British officials had intervened behind closed doors to persuade the UN to alter the conclusion of the report to rule sabotage as an external attack. In 1992, two of Hammarskjöld's top advisors, Connor Cruz O'Brien and George Ivan Smith, wrote in The Guardian that they had evidence that their boss's plane had been shot down by accident by mercenaries in the employ of Belgian, American, and British mining interests, which feared Hammarskjöld's peacemaking would jeopardize their business interests, which again, just a whole other different option. Like, why is that even an option now that, like, okay, they might have done it, but it was by accident? Göran Björk Dahl, a Swedish national whose father worked in the region, began researching the UN chief's death and conducting interviews with local charcoal makers who had witnessed the Albertina's final descent. Rhodesian and UN investigators at the time largely dismissed the testimony of Black African eyewitnesses. Of course they would. The case received a boost when Susan Williams, a British scholar who grew up in Zambia, revisited the crime, unearthing previously unseen documents from the archive papers of Lord Cuthbert Alport, who was the British High Commissioner in Rhodesia in 1961, who was at the Ndola airport on the night of the crash, including a secret report by Neil Ritchie, an MI6 agent who organized the planned meeting between Hammarskjöld and Dushanbe. Williams' 2011 book, Who Killed Hammarskjöld? The UN, the Cold War, and the White Supremacy in Africa, helped spur the establishment a year later of the Hammarskjöld Commission, a voluntary body of international jurists and lawyers chaired by a British judge, Stephen Sedley. Williams has since fed documents to the UN investigators. Quote, the response of the US and the UK to Judge Oathman have been appalling and arrogant, end quote, Williams told Foreign Policy in an email. Quote, but they are entirely consistent with the behavior of those states at the time of the crash. When Britain was the colonial and racist ruler of Northern Rhodesia, now Zambia, and the US was interfering in the process of decolonization of Africa. Both the UK and the United States stated that all relevant information had already been made available, but this was not true in either case. End quote. The Hammarskjöld Commission concluded in its final 2013 report that, quote, there is persuasive evidence that the aircraft was subjected to some form of attack or threat as it circled to land in Ndola. It is highly likely that the entirety of the local and regional Ndola radio traffic on the night of the 17th and 18th of September of 61 was tracked and recorded by the NSA and possibly also by the CIA. End quote. These findings prompted the UN General Assembly in 2015 to adopt a resolution calling on then UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to create a panel of experts to examine the case and determine whether there was enough evidence to merit further investigation. Ban appointed Oathman, who was expected to conclude his report in September. At the time of Hammarskjöld's death, US and Britain had extensive intelligence assets in the region, including CIA agents and NSA surveillance capabilities. But much of what the UN has learned about US activities in the region has come from independent researchers, private archives, and other governments. Oathman has asked the US to provide access to intercepts and other evidence of communications from Hammarskjöld's plane or other US aircrafts in the area at the time of the crash. On the night of the crash, there were at least three US planes, including US Army and Navy attaches aircraft, equipped with state-of-the-art surveillance equipment at the airport in Ndola. One US intelligence official, Charles Southall, recalled in interviews having overheard intercepts of a known European mercenary pilot nicknamed the Lone Ranger shooting down Hammarskjöld's plane. The U.S. ambassador to Congo, Edmund A. Gullion, sent a report to Washington on the day that Hammarskjöld was killed, stating the plane, quote, may have been shot down, end quote. Quote, the historical record strongly suggests that governments, including the U.S., which had a presence in and around the Congo region at the time, may hold such evidence, end quote. Oathman wrote in an annex to his report in 2019. But the United Nations has provided limited confirmation for years. Washington denied that Paul Abram, a former U.S. Air Force Security Service officer, also overheard transmissions of an attack the night of the crash, worked for the U.S., only acknowledging that his link to U.S. intelligence after he furnished the American officials with his government identification. So he was giving information. They're like, no, he didn't work for us. And then he like literally had to put his like badge down to show them that he did. A spokesperson for the U.S. State Department said the United States takes Oathman's inquiry seriously and shares his interest in understanding the circumstances of death of Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld. Quote, over the years, the United States has shared over 1,000 pages of previously classified documents with the UN investigator, end quote, the spokesperson said, speaking on condition of anonymity. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the official added, quote, conducted yet another exhaustive search for U.S. intelligence archives and did not find any additional information that would shed light on the circumstances of Secretary General Hammarskjöld's death, end quote. British and Rhodesian colonial intelligence officials were also intercepting communications suggesting that they may have pertinent clues buried in their archives. Oathman is seeking access to documents describing the activities of Ritchie, the MI6 agent, and other British officials who were tasked with organizing the meeting between Hammarskjöld and Dushanbe. Oathman also sought information about a Belgian mercenary pilot, Jan van Rijsige, who had served in the British Royal Air Force during World War II and is alleged by a colleague to have admitted to flying the plane that brought down Hammarskjöld's aircraft. Pierre Coppens, a colleague of the Belgian pilot, asserted in the documentary Cold Case Hammarskjöld that Van Rysselman was known as the Lone Ranger. Oathman is also seeking information from the South African government about an alleged plot by a paramilitary group known as South African Institute for Maritime Research to assassinate Hammarskjöld by placing a bomb in his plane before it left the airfield in Leopoldville, now the Congolese capital of Kinshasa, en route to Ndola. In a March 2019 letter to South Africa, Oathman said he understood that the South African government had located documents detailing the plan dubbed Operation Celeste, but those documents have never been shared with the UN. And I think I have two more article quotations I need to read from now. This one's from The Guardian, article titled Dag Hammarskjöld Evidence Suggests UN Chief's Plane Was Shot Down. Jan van Rysselman has been named as a possible attacker before, but has also been described simply as a Belgian pilot. The Observer can now reveal that he had extensive ties to Britain, including a British mother and wife, trained with the RAF, and was decorated by Britain for his service in the Second World War. Van Rysselman, whose father was Belgian, escaped occupied Europe at the start of the war to join the resistance in England. He trained with the RAF and flew missions over Nazi-held areas during the period he met and married his British wife, cementing a lifelong connection. For decades, von Rysselman appeared to have proof that he wasn't flying in the region on the night Hammarskjöld's plane, the Albertina, came down outside of Ndola in Zambia, then called Northern Rhodesia. Flight logs, meticulous records of where and when he flew, appear to show von Rysselman was not flying for most of that month, returning to duty only on September 20th. However, Roger Bracco, another mercenary flying for the Katangis, told filmmakers that his colleagues' logbooks are dotted with apparent forgeries. He does not believe that von Rysselman shot down Hammarskjöld, but when asked in an interview for the film if he considered the logbook a fake, he responded, "I won't say so, but I didn't recognize the story it told."
Von Rysselman said this?
No, a guy that flew with him.
Oh, okay. I was like, interesting.
Rysselman unfortunately died before most of this investigation actually happened, which is a shame because this happened like 40 years after it should have happened.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense that he's dead now and everyone's just having this hearsay photo. Okay.
Leafing through the book, he later directly accuses von Rysselman of forgery. Quote, "This is fake," end quote, Bracco says bluntly of one flight destination and goes on to add that some of the names listed for co-pilots are not real. A friend has also come forward to claim that less than a decade after Hammarskjöld's death, van Rysselman told him he had attacked the plane. Pierre Coppens met van Rysselman in 1965 when he was flying for a parachute training center in Belgium. Over several conversations, he claimed the pilot detailed how he overcame various technical challenges to down the plane unaware who was traveling inside. Quote, "He didn't know," end quote, Coppens said. Quote, "He said, I made the mission, and that's all. And then I had to go back and save my life," end quote. And then, Chelsea, because we're in 2025, Oathman's report came out in 2022, and I have an excerpt from it.
Okay.
And this is where I'm going to end it off, is after this, part of the report.
Okay, I thought you had something from 2025.
No. No, we are going to cut it off there. There might be more. I haven't looked into it. I'm just rereading the script. So, as mandated, I have also sought to draw conclusions from the investigations already conducted. As in 2019, I assess that it remains plausible that an external attack or threat was the cause of the crash. However, it is not reasonable to reach a conclusion as to the cause of the tragic event based on presently available but incomplete information. This is because material information that appears to have been created or held by member states remains undisclosed. In March of 2020, and subsequently, I sent requests for information to four key member states that had been identified in 2019 and that were urged by the assembly to engage in further process of disclosing relevant records. Chelsea, do you want to guess who?
Richard Doty.
No, fucking Doty.
I knew it.
The Russian Federation, South Africa, the UK, and the United States. None of them are being helpful in any way. The 2017 and 2019 reports concluded that the burden of proof had shifted to certain member states to show that they had conducted a full review of records and archives in their custody or possession. I respectfully submit that the burden of proof to conduct a full review of our records and archives resulting in full disclosure has not been discharged at the present time.
Mm.
Indeed, information received from other sources under the present mandate underscores that it is almost certain that these member states created, held, or were otherwise aware of specific important information regarding the cause of the tragic event. That information is yet to be disclosed. So, the answer is probably out there, written down by one of those states, and they won't disclose it.
You really think it's written down somewhere? We shot it down.
Yes, I actually do. But who is it?
What do we make of this, that there's so many different nations who don't necessarily work together holding back this information?
And had completely different motivations for doing it, but will not turn it over. Like, Russia has succinctly different reasons than the UK and the US for why they might want Hammarskjöld dead.
Do you think that it's because each one secretly thinks that they probably did it?
I don't know, and that's such a weird thing. Like, you would think if one of these groups had the information on the other nations, they would disclose it.
It seems that that's the only logical thing in my mind, is that they're not conducting it because they, like, whoever they're asking is legitimately, like, it was probably us. So that's the only way it makes sense.
But how could it be both the US and Russia?
Because each
they
one
wouldn't have worked
that
together at that time.
That's the only reason I could think that they wouldn't, is because they think that it's probably them. Nothing else makes sense. Like, themselves. Like, the U.S. doesn't want to do it because the U.S. thinks it's them. Russia doesn't want to do it because
Do you
Russia
really think that that's what it is? Is they went to their respective spy agencies and they said, hey, did we do this? And they said, I don't know, maybe. And they said, okay, best not to look into it.
Yeah, like, something like that. It has to be. There's no other thing that makes sense, because in the way you tell it, like, everyone did it. But not everyone would have done it. Like, I don't see, like, Russia and the U.S. or, like, Russia and Britain or Belgium, like, work together on doing it.
I could see, like, two or three of them working together, particularly, like, Belgium, the U.S., and mining interests in the area. But there's just, like, so many different groups. Do you think it was, like, a Rube Goldberg of assassination attempts that accidentally worked together?
Maybe. And it just, it does, that doesn't make sense, like, in this.
I want to bring it back to that whole thing that in the conspiracy world, the UN is considered like a big boogeyman. And they're asking these countries to just nicely, please turn over your records you have for when you killed our leader. And they're just like, nah, we don't have anything. And the UN is just like, well, they won't give us the documents. And that's where it ends. That's how much power they have.
Please. And they're like, nah. And they're like, okay.
Nah. Yeah, we don't have anything. Did you look? No. Okay.
Okay, well,
so maybe we find out in like 30 years it was Journey to the Fringe, but I just don't know.
In some weird time warp. It was probably us too. Everyone did it at this point, so
yeah.
Why not Journey to the Fringe?
Yeah, it's that time that we had Andrew Basiago on the show in about 4 years.
Yeah. That was a fun time.
It is such a captivating potential assassination, I should say. Because there is a chance that the plane just crashed at the end of this. But, like, nobody ever talks about this one.
I don't think there's a potential that it just crashed, being what's unless it is that it just crashed and everybody's like, fuck this guy. Like, everybody's making it more than it's out to be. So I'm just not going to cooperate.
It could actually be that these spy agencies want to look more powerful than they are and let the perception that they did this plane crash sit up.
Want it for
that's a low chance, but that is out there, I guess.
No, that works with the other theory too.
And let's face it, it's probably pretty cheap to go buy off the testimony of African villagers in the middle of the Congo or in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe.
Oh, yeah, I did that last
to
week.
Tell them, say, hey, like, you saw it get shot down. But yeah, Chelsea, what do you think of this story?
As long as it doesn't come back to us, I think it's a lot of twists and turns and whodunits.
Usually as like time goes on, especially like 50 years afterwards, it narrows. And it's just like, every time there was a story went further on, there's like, and here's another one who might have done it.
And I did like Von Risler's name. Big fan. It was probably
Jan von Risigan.
He had the name to do it.
I'm pretty sure he was there at the time, but whether or not he shot it down or it exploded and he just happened to be there, I don't know. It's so hard to say. And like then, who was he acting for? Because it turns out he flew for the British during World War II.
But it's not like it's not out of the ordinary. Like, I don't think it's beyond his capabilities to have been hired by another. He may have been approached by everybody. Maybe that's why nobody's saying anything.
Maybe even Hammarskjöld himself.
Oh, nobody even mentioned that.
But in any event, that's probably enough down the rabbit hole on that one. I love this episode. I hope you enjoyed it the second time around. That hopefully has better sound quality. But in any event, I have been Taylor, here with Chelsea. We are Journey to the Fringe. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to Journey to the Fringe. If you have liked what you have listened to, please like, share, subscribe, or follow, depending on what venue you are listening to us through. Also, please, if possible, leave a 5-star review, as that really helps us in the algorithms. Should you wish to interact with us, please check us out on your social media of choice. I bet you we are there. And if you really want to communicate with us and give us ideas for new episodes or tell us that we're wrong and terrible, either way, please send us an email at journeytothefringe@gmail.com. For now, I'll see you in the next episode.